This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name is Andrew.
Trumpet of the Swan.
That is the best known trumpet.
It's like
you could do taps, I guess. Or is that a bugle?
Well, okay, we will talk about taps today.
Okay.
It does get played by a trumpet in this book.
Uh-huh.
The other one I was thinking of is Trumpet of the Swan. But wait, that was not a good Star Wars.
The Trumpet.
The Trumpet.
Yeah. What about that? That's what I think about when I think about the Trumpet.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. We can't do that. Welcome to our book podcast, Andrew.
Every week one of us reads a book that we've never read before, and we tell the other one of us about it, and we just kind of goof about and have a good time, and you get to listen to that.
Yeah.
This week, Craig, what did you read?
I read The Trumpet of... The Trumpet?
Leave it in.
I read... There's so many wuz coming up. I read The Trumpet of the Swan by E.B. White. Looking at a W when I said Trumpet.
By Elwin Brooks White.
Can you imagine if Elmer Fudd covered that song and he had to go the trumpet? So this book was our patron's choice for the month of March. Andrew said, what if we do marching band instruments? And I said, there's only so many. What if we just do instruments and still a marching band instrument one? So that's good.
Yeah, no, people were on board with my idea.
Yeah. Yeah, they knew what you were picking up and putting down.
The month March is the same as the word March. Can we do anything with that?
Can we do anything? Is that a thing? What Andrew asks me. Now, Andrew, we have covered E.B. White before on the show.
We have in episode 15, where we did The Elements of Style.
Yep.
Which he also wrote with Strunk.
Yes.
And episode 290, where we did Charlotte's Web.
Excuse me. He wrote it with Strunk.
No, we were Strunk.
Sorry, and the other one?
Charlotte's Web, episode 290.
290, which you had read, and I was less familiar with than I should have been.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever read Trumpet of the Swan?
I never read Trumpet of the Swan because we had a copy of it, and I just never got around to it.
Okay, sure.
Too busy reading Hatchet and Dog Song and Charlotte's Web.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I also think something about the title made me forget that it was E.B. White a little bit in style.
Yeah, like it's not as kid, like Stuart Little, I don't know, he's called Stuart Little, it's like a little happy mouse on the cover.
Yeah.
Charlotte's Web, you got a spider, you got a pig, like, I don't know, it's interesting, let's read about that web. Trumpet of the Swan sounds like so poetic and grown up and stayed somehow, I don't know.
Yes, that is exactly what I anticipated, and as I started reading it, I was like, oh no, this is the guy that wrote Charlotte's Web, I forgot. And so that was kind of a fun journey I went on with this book, which is a very silly animal book.
It sounded silly. I wasn't expecting it to be so silly.
Yeah, it's kind of silly and also all over the place in terms of what it's about, and like,
sure,
you know, we like to think deeply about books here sometimes, and we like to find some fun in like digging into how a children's book works.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot here in the silly and in the non-silly zone.
Sure.
Zones, yeah. Rather. But what do we need to know about Elwin Brooks White, Andrew?
We've talked about Elwin already. So just briefly, he was born in 1899, died in 1985. This is the third of three children's books that he wrote.
The last Stuart one, Little. Right?
Yeah, the last one. And I think like probably the last like proper novel. Like he had other stuff that came out during and after his life, but it was mostly like letters and different like collected things. So yeah, Stuart Little came out in 1945, this in 1952, and then Trumpet of the Stuart Little 1945, Webb, yeah. Charlotte's Web 1952, this being the Trumpet of the Swan in 1970.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know, like it's just I think Trumpet of the Swan is maybe the one of them with the least cultural footprint. Like I don't know that there have been a bunch, like there have been some adaptations of Trumpet of the Swan, but like no, I don't know that there's been like a major motion picture.
There has. Or,
oh, there has. Whoa, really?
Well, there has been a motion picture.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah, that's not what I said.
Fair enough.
Because Stuart Little had a movie with Gina Davis in it. Like, did Trumpet of the Swan have a movie with Gina Davis
no,
in it?
No, but Reese Witherspoon, Jason Alexander, Dee Bradley Baker, and Seth Green, and Carol Burnett were in it. And Joe Mantegna was in it.
Film was this? Was this, this is not the animated film based on the book by Rich Animation Studios, is it?
It is.
Whoa. All
right, distributed by TriStar.
Cast. Yeah.
Now, of course, I don't think it was very well received. I did go on.
It did get a 14% in Rotten Tomatoes. So.
I did go on Common Sense Media, and KMFan97, who is a kid, said, this is for all ages, but it's without a doubt the worst animated film I've ever seen.
Okay. All right. So maybe it's the movie's fault that it doesn't have a bigger cultural footprint than
maybe.
It does.
We'll talk about this later when we're talking about the book in context, but through a master's thesis that I was skimming in reference for, you know, for this episode, there's a lot of other stuff in it that was not Trumpet of the Swan that I was skimming, but pulled a quote from an E.B. White biography by Scott Elledge, and purportedly by Elledge, quote, he was dissatisfied with the book, and after he had turned it in, he wished he had held it a year and then rewritten it as he had done with his other children's books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any other source than Elledge's, than this quote from Elledge's biography on that. I can imagine a world in which another run at this book helps the character of Louis or Lewis. I don't know how to pronounce his name because it's spelled Lewis, but they reference Louis Armstrong.
I think it's got to be Louis. It's Louis for sure.
It's got to be Louis. Okay.
Yeah, it's got to be Louis Armstrong.
He might be more of a cultural character in you know, like Wilbur and Stuart Little.
If well, and Charlotte's Web had a lot of strong secondary characters
yes,
as well.
That's
like
true.
Templeton the Rat and others.
Yes, that's
true. I don't know if this book has as many of those. So yeah, this is what I'm talking about. There's the Gina Davis Stuart Little, and then in 2006, there's the Charlotte's Web film with Dakota Fanning as Fern.
Oh wow!
And Julia Roberts as the voice of Charlotte.
Sure.
And Steve Buscemi as Templeton the Rat.
Yeah.
And Oprah as a goose. Like, yeah. So this is this is what I'm talking about.
Is
I'm
that
not
Homeward
talking about
Bound animals or animals with mouths that move?
That I don't know.
Okay. Well, Dakota Fanning is gonna. She's like a real human girl.
Yeah. No. There's like live action. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
There is a live action cast.
Babe
that also includes Bo Bridges.
Sure.
And then a voice cast for the animals.
Okay. Okay.
But it's not a rinky dink independent animated thing like the Trumpet of the Swan movie is.
That poster image for that thing is real whack.
This is some fun Wikipedia. So this Trumpet of the Swan movie came out in 2001, and Wikipedia says it was the last film based on a book by E.B. White until 2006's Charlotte's Web. Like, 5 years isn't that long. Like, why are we talking about
this? Ah, that rules.
Oh, boy.
The only other things I think I had were that the original illustrator was a guy named Edward Frasino. I read an edition that had the 2000 editions illustrations by Fred Marcellino,
mm-hmm.
Who, among other things, had done a cover for The Handmaid's Tale, Bonfire of the Vanities. He had done an edition of Puss in Boots in the 90s. Generally, you know, out there being a visual artist and illustrator. Mm-hmm. I liked the illustrations in this a lot. There's mm-hmm. a couple really good ones of a trumpet holding a swan holding a trumpet that are very silly. a lot of personality to them. And yeah, that's all I got.
Yeah, it's I had a little bit in the New York Times, like this is the contemporary New York Times review by John Updike.
Yeah.
Who writes just thinking about this being sort of the lesser of E.B. White's three children's books,
yeah.
But because the other two are Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web, like that doesn't mean this is a bad book.
Sure.
But he says E.B. White's third novel for children joins the two others on the shelf of classics. While not quite so sprightly as Stuart Little and less rich in personalities and incident than Charlotte's Web, The Trumpet of the Swan has superior qualities of its own. It's the most spacious and serene of the three, the one most imbued with the author's sense of the precious instinctual heritage represented by wild nature.
Yeah.
Its story most persuasively offers itself to children as a parable of growing, yet does not lack the inimitable tone. That's a word
that's a tough one.
A lot of trouble. Inimitable.
Yeah. It's tough.
I have trouble
saying
it. Yeah. inimitable tone of the two earlier works, the simplicity that never condescends, the straight and earnest telling that happens upon rather than veers into comedy. The grace and humor and praise of life and the good backbone of succinctness that Eudora Welty noted nearly 20 years ago reviewing Charlotte's Web in these pages.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
So just, you know, it's a good book. It doesn't reach the heights, I don't think, quite.
I would say, yeah,
Weber,
it does
Stuart
not.
Little, but that doesn't mean there's not a lot of good stuff in it.
No, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
If you like to talk about books, and, you know, that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, I have some other stuff that's probably better discussed, like in the context of the story. I did want to talk about this website that I never stumbled upon in research before I did find this time. It's a site called novelengineering.org.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Please. I don't think this is relevant and closed it. Tell me more.
No, it's not. It's not relevant, but it is fun. It's
okay.
like an educational curriculum built around children's books that is for like middle grade. Like engineering students.
Steam, baby. Steam powered.
And so there's a page for The Trumpet of the Swan. And what this curriculum does is they don't talk about like sort of the themes of the book or you know, like a conventional book reporty sort of way. They identify what the potential engineering problems are in the book and how they could be solved with contraptions.
I love teachers.
Building. Problems identified by students. The eggs in the mother and father swan's nest are in danger from predators. Louis is unable to communicate. It is difficult for the father swan to steal a trumpet. And the students design solutions like an alarm system of string and plastic cups that will alert the swans if a predator is getting near the nest, and also protective fence to protect the nest.
Yes!
Device that goes on the swan's wings so they don't get as tired flying.
Yes!
I just like that they don't want to solve what the conflict of the book is. They just want to like make these swans' lives better with technology. they also have pages for the mouse and the motorcycle.
Ooh.
Where they're all of the solutions designed by students are exclusively focused around how to get Ralph out of the motorcycle out of the wastebasket.
Out of the wastebasket.
So they fall into.
Wow.
And then there's James and the Giant Peach. Where the students design an ice ball deflection system and a peach lifting mechanism to hoist the peach out of the sea and away from sharks.
What a cool website.
So it seems fun. Novelengineering.org. I don't know. Like, it looks like it may have been a while since it was updated last, maybe.
Sure,
but,
sure, sure.
Let me see what they got. Upcoming workshops and events.
Upcoming been a bit.
Okay, none of these have dates on them.
Okay.
But I just thought it was funny.
That
it's
is
a cool,
cool
site.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break and then I can tell you about the book.
Okay.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Andrew, if you had an extra hour in your day, what would you do?
I'd probably spend it thinking I should go to bed.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what I do with a lot of the hours that I have already. I was going to say sleep, but just knowing myself and being realistic about it, I would probably not be sleeping, but thinking that I should be.
Thinking that you should be. Well, you know, the best way to squeeze that thing, whether it's sleep or thinking about sleep, into your schedule is to know what's important to you. Is it sleep? Is it thinking about sleep? And you got to make it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so that you can do more of it. I think therapy is a great tool for identifying what's working in your life. I know many people who have started therapy because of like a particular problem or situation they're working on, but the folks I know who've stuck with it often talk about how it helps them stay grounded in what they care about, why, and how to center that in their lives. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to fit into your schedule. You fill out a brief questionnaire, then get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch at any time for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy, Andrew, with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/overdue today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/overdue. All right, so I think I know where we should start, given what we both thought this book might be, based on the title. So the book opens with a little boy named Sam Beaver. He's like 10 or 11 years old, I think. And he goes on camping trips with his dad. They live in Montana, I think, but they go to Nowheresville, Canada. Like, literally.
Is that the name of the?
No. Like, it's in, like, Western Canada. They hire a.
There's a boring Oregon, so, like, I just never assume that there can't be a town name like that.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. They have to hire a man with a plane to, like, drop them in the woods. Like, it's that type of camping. And they just
like
do
in,
that
like in Hatchet. They have a hatchet, except that everything goes okay.
And he loves it. He loves being in nature. Sam does. He's a young boy who doesn't quite know what he wants to do with his life, and it's kind of exciting to get out of the, you know, the busy Montana rat race, I guess, for 10-year-olds.
Montana rat race.
And it is described that for him, like, sitting among the animals in nature is like what other people experience when they go to church. Like, it is just a profound, you know, Henry Thoreau experience for him, sort of thing. And we get these, like, occasionally we get these little journal entries, and these continue throughout the book, and this gives you a good, like, window into his charming little brain, and this closes the first chapter. So he doesn't tell his dad about this. He keeps it to himself. I saw a pair of trumpeter swans today on a small pond east of camp. The female has a nest with eggs in it. I saw three, but I'm going to put four in the picture. I think she was laying another one. This is the greatest discovery I ever made in my entire life. I did not tell Pop. My bird book says baby swans are called cygnets. I'm going back tomorrow to visit the great swans again. I heard a fox bark today. Why does a fox bark? Is it because he is mad or worried or hungry or because he is sending a message to another fox? Italics. Why does a fox bark?
They made a song about that, didn't they?
They did. A song
Why does
I
a
haven't
fox bark?
Thought about in a while.
Yeah, because it's not good. It's bad. It's stupid and bad. What?
So that's Sam. And this
a nature lover
and a little nature boy, and I thought, like, okay, this is still kind of fitting the pastoral book I thought we before I remembered what was gonna happen.
Yeah, you haven't had any, like, goofy animal pratfalls yet.
Well, then we get a perspective shift to some swans.
Okay.
Who talk to each other using human English in their you know, in their swan language.
Well, and, what else would they speak?
Well, I just want to clarify that they are not speaking out loud human English. Like,
okay, sure.
They speak swan to each other, but we are privy to
their
words.
We experience
it
as English, yes. Okay.
And, like, Pop, okay, so they don't have names. They're just the mother and the father. Often, you know, a male swan is called a cob, so sometimes it'll just be the cob said or whatever. So some of my notes just call him Papa Cob. And they have seen Sam see them, and they're kind of confused because boys shouldn't be in the middle of the woods like this.
Are they worried for themselves, or are they worried for the boy?
Well, themselves a little bit.
Okay, all right.
At what Papa Cop says, quote, "We are deep in the wilds of Canada."
Uh-huh.
What do you think I love about this?
Deep in the wilds of, like, the geese would recognize nation states?
Yes,
stuff?
That's okay. Yes. I love it when animals know about man-made borders.
I mean, not wish some of our politicians to learn about borders, am I right?
Jeez, nah. I also think it's kind of cool that I think it's cool. Okay. The swans don't have their own parallel nation states. Like, they don't have their own, no other animal in this book has like a sense of territory. This is not a book about like animals having their, like, a Pixar like shadow society that we just don't know about because we're not animals, right? They do animal things. They just happen to be able to talk to each other, basically.
Okay.
They don't have like kind of their own names for human things. Like, you know, when we get to the part where the swans somehow know what a trumpet is, they're not like, oh, the horny majig or whatever, you know. You know what type of book I'm talking about that do something like that.
Yeah, the type of book with a horny majig in
it. A horny majig in it.
Chuck Tingle books.
He does say, at one point, I've never felt more seen in a book. He says, I do not wish to be observed, the Cobb says when he thinks about the boy seeing him. Sam does score some points with the swans by scaring off a fox. This was probably covered in that novel engineering lesson. Fox does like creep up to try and eat some eggs, and Sam throws a stick at it.
Sure.
And the swans are like, oh, I guess that kid is cool.
Okay.
They have 5 babies from their eggs. And you need to know that Papa Cobb is very highfalutin in his language. He's very verbose.
I had read about that. This is a very, very perspicacious
a
swan.
Signet at last. I am a father with all the pleasant duties and awesome responsibilities of fatherhood. Oh, blessed little son of mine, how good it is to see your face peering through the protecting feathers of your mother's breast under these fair skies with the pond so quiet and peaceful in the long light of afternoon. And then Mama Swan says, how do you know it's a boy? Like, she's always undercutting him. Like, that is the repeating joke, is he will go on for a paragraph and a half, and she will interrupt him and go, stop it. You've said this before. Shut up. And so they have 5 signets, and the 5th one, Louis, doesn't make any noise. He just doesn't make any noise. And when Papa Cobb shows off his signets, he's like, the book is like, he felt the need to show them off to someone, so he swam them over to Sam to show them to Sam. And all of the little baby swans beep at Sam, except for the 5th one, who can't beep, so he pulls on his shoelace with his little beak, and then they swim away.
Okay.
And that's like the setup of the book, is that Sam and Louie are going to be friends, and Louie can't talk in swan.
Sure.
This, I'm all over the place with this book a little.
So he can't, like, he not only can he not trumpet, like, just
he
like
cannot
a swan
make noise
trumpets, he just can't speak swan English to the other swans.
He cannot vocalize at all
in the country of Canada.
Correct.
Okay.
Which they do know about.
Yes.
So, like, I love, and we're going to keep talking about all the kind of wacky human animal stuff in this book. I think it's very fun and very silly to talk about. Some of it's very strange when you think about it. This book is a story about disability, and I also think its depiction is kind of all over the map. Some of that I think is that it's from 1970, and so I think the book's heart is in the right place.
But also probably, I mean, I'm not going to actually be guessing because I've read enough about what the book is about. But like, if you're writing a book about disability in 1970 and you're well-intentioned about it, you're probably treating it as like a problem to be fixed so the person can be quote unquote normal.
Correct.
Or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And so there is this like he has to overcome the problem of his muteness. And specifically about halfway through the book, it is a problem of his muteness because if he cannot talk or sing, he will not be able to fall in love and have swan sex. They don't say sex, but you know what it means. Make swan babies. And the swan that he falls in love with literally has no character or personality. It's like a real flaw in White's writing, I think, in this book. Like, if there's one thing I wish he would have punched up, it was like the character of Serena the Swan at all.
Yeah.
And he also like,
I think if you, as a counterpoint to that,
sure,
I think if you were going to punch your character up at all, you would inevitably end up asking, like, if she's so, if she's such a deep, rich, fully realized character, why doesn't she just like Louis the way he is, or
well,
something like that?
Good point. Yes, that's so true. Yes. You know, I read one article on, we're going to talk about a couple of the different, like, adaptive devices that Louis uses over the course of the book.
Yeah, I have something about that when we
yeah.
get to it.
So I read a positive take on that, and that, you know, he's got a couple of different adaptive devices. It doesn't need to be a like fully positive depiction for it to feel like good rep, where it's like, you know, this is, these are some of the challenges you might face using devices, and not everything is like a, you know, a magic fix. And that's kind of worth knowing. But it does have a lot of language where, like, okay, so they learn that he can't talk. And some of it, like, kind of shows up, like, there's just a conversation between the mother and the father where they're like, hey, do you ever notice he doesn't ever talk? He doesn't ever make noise? And the dad sort of has a crisis. He literally says, fatherhood is quite a burden at best. I do not want the added strain of having a defective child, a child that has something the matter with him.
Okay.
And you're like, this, I don't like this. I don't like reading this. This is a bummer. I think you can put that in the book because you're trying to show that that sucks. I don't know that that is exactly what E.B. White is doing. I think ultimately what Father does is he's like, well, I got to get him something that can help him communicate, which is what he does. And that's like, it actually is very endearing because of, you know, what the father goes through to do it. He's a swan. He has limited ability to craft tools and prosthetics.
Yeah, I mean, and but like as a parent, that would be your impulse. Like like and maybe you wouldn't think of your child as defective, but nevertheless you would set about figuring out a way to help them communicate and express themselves and relate to others, you know.
The thing that really stings to a modern reader is how often all of the language around like defective or, you know, just really negative language is used and never like there's no like corrective to them in any way. Or you know, I think you would expect a modern book treat with the same like setup to kind of unpack that a little bit more. And so if you're reading this book with a kid or something like that, maybe you would do that. But he is like, he does, the mom and dad talk about how she fell in love with the dad's voice. And so like the dad is like, well, I got to make sure my son has like some way to communicate so that somebody can fall in love with him someday. Because he did say that he heard something from his wife's lips, which is a weird thing to say about a swan. All right, just need to point that out. Swans don't have lips. Even though this swan plays a trumpet, you definitely need lips to play a trumpet. But anyway.
Yes, well.
There's another scene where the dad pulls Louis aside and is like, hey, Louis, you can't talk, can you? And you're getting Louis's thoughts where he's like, dad, get to the point. Like, kind of Garfield style, where he's like,
sure. I mean, in Garfield, it's never, a lot of the time, it's not clear whether John can hear Garfield or
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I did Google that in part of my research.
Can John understand Garfield?
I kind of wanted to make sure that Garfield can understand John, and I do think he can.
Garfield can understand John for sure, because he's always razzing him and responding to him, but I don't know whether John can understand Garfield. I've got to imagine, usually, it's ambiguous, and sometimes John seems to understand Garfield so that some dumb joke about lasagna can work. Yeah.
Sure. We are Garfield experts here on Overdue.
We've read The Fat Cat 3-Pack #1, but you know, there's still several dozen other Fat Cat 3-packs that we haven't cracked yet.
Patreon.com/OverduePod. Yeah. Louis has this conversation with his dad where his dad is like, you have a speech defect. And it's a really kind of hard conversation to read. Louis is sad about it and kind of scared to be told that he's different.
Mm-hmm.
His dad is like, I will find you a trumpet. Don't worry. I've heard, you know, I've seen trumpets out in the world. And that is clearly what you need. You are a trumpeter swan after all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what is going to happen in this book.
Yeah, I think when people respond to it positively as a depiction of disability, I think they're responding to some of like the emotional realities of,
yes,
of like not being able to make yourself understood, or like maybe sometimes wishing that you were quote unquote normal, so that, mm-hmm, you wouldn't have to put up with some of the things that you have to put up with. Like, I think that's pretty typical feelings to feel. This is from a Nerdy Book Club review. That's not my qualitative judgment of what
that's
the book
what it's
club
called,
is like.
Right?
That's what, yeah, the site is called. A little essay called Disability and the Extraordinary and Trumpet of the Swan by Tina L. Peterson. And she says, any reader who has ever felt out of place or without a voice will identify with Louis's frustration when he cannot make himself understood by his friends and family. My heart breaks when he sadly erases from his slate the words hi there after they elicit blank stares from his parents and siblings.
Yeah.
Are you going to tell me about how this swan can write English letters?
That's the very next thing. Yes.
All right.
I need to tell you this.
Mm-hmm.
So they migrate south from Canada to Montana.
Are they aware of?
Yep. They know what Montana is.
Okay. Do they talk about the United States at all, or is it just Montana?
I think they know about United States. It's kind of unclear.
It's just interesting that they go from Canada, which is a really big, like a lot of different provinces,
to Montana,
which is a specific United States state.
The specific place they are going is it's like Red Rock Lakes. I think it is a preserve that in the mid 20th century had started actually doing trumpeter swan conservation. There were like only a few hundred of them in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And then 70 years later, there were like 3,000 of them, like enough, yeah, that they could start having them migrate again.
Mm-hmm.
The human characters in the book, Sam and his dad, do note that it was odd that there were trumpeter swans even leaving Montana at all, because they thought that almost all of them were at this conservatory sort of thing.
Sure. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So they go back there. And Louis at this point is like, man.
Louis.
Oh, sorry, Louis. It's the S gets me. Louis Armstrong. Okay, Louis. He's like, okay, if I'm defective in one respect, he says, I should try and develop myself along other lines. I will learn to read and write. Then I will hang a small slate around my neck and carry a chalk pencil. In that way, I will be able to communicate with anybody who can read. This is the first time that anyone has said the word chalk or, mm-hmm, pencil or, mm-hmm, slate. I don't know how this bird.
How did Louis learn about this?
How did he? This is the big thing in this book. It's a fun time if you want to read this book and just think about all the times that a bird knows something that no one has ever taught it before. It's fun.
Birds are born. Like, a lot of animals are born kind of knowing how to walk. A lot of stuff that we have to work hard to teach our own children.
You're right. You're right.
Animals just come out knowing. So,
swans
probably know about like chalk and stuff.
He just
right out of the egg
knows what reading and writing is, and decides I will go read and learn to read and write. And where can I do that? At a school, clearly. I must go find the human Sam Beaver, mm-hmm, and I will fly to his town, and he will help me go to school, which, uh-huh, is what Louis does.
That makes sense.
He doesn't tell his family this plan, and he's gone for 18 months.
Wow, that is a long time. How long does a trumpeter swan even live?
That's a good question.
Trumpeter swan lifespan. I mean, birds last
birds
for
live
a while.
Yeah,
25 years. All right, that's fine.
Okay, all right. I mean, that's a full fifth of his life. He just went away to school, I guess.
Cygnus buccinator.
Yeah, they say that at one point in the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The.
So he goes to school. Like, Sam's family is like, I guess we can take this bird in. Sam recognizes Louis because Louis pulls on his shoestring again. And Sam is like, hey, is there a problem where, like, you can't make swan noises? And Louis nods. And so,
okay.
So this, at this point, you know that swans understand human English.
Swans understand human English as spoken by humans and not just the, like, stand-in for human English that they speak to each other.
Correct. Yes.
See, that's another thing that somebody brought up. Mary Ness or Mari Ness in a Reactor Mag.
Yeah, the Reactor Mag article. Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, and I think you, when you were talking earlier about the, like, different assistive devices for different situations, that comes from this. But she also notes toward the bottom that it's a little strange that some of the plot later revolves around swans staying in a zoo, which, if swans are sentient and can communicate with humans, is just a jail for animals.
It's pretty rough. It's pretty rough. There's one line from Sam Beaver during the whole zoo stuff that, like, attempts to make it okay.
Okay.
Which we'll talk about.
It's lampshading the animal prison.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
So Sam brings Louis to school, and he goes to kindergarten, and Mrs. Hammerbotham just guesses his name on the fourth try.
Okay.
She does not miss a beat. She's like, there's a goose in my kindergarten class, because Sam's like, well, he doesn't know how to read or write. He should go to kindergarten first. And he goes in there, and she's like, is your name Joe, Jonathan, Donald, Louie? And the swan nods, and she's like, all right, it's Louie. Let's go.
Mm-hmm. And he's 1970. There's still a pretty narrow, acceptable band of white men's names that the swan could be.
And she basically just starts having him practice letters. Like, on the first day, he writes the word catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty long word.
Yes. And all he's doing is he has the manual dexterity to copy the symbols that she is writing on the chalkboard herself. Mm-hmm. And from there...
Is this done with, like, a prehensile neck kind of situation?
Yeah, he's got his big swan neck that he can just scoop around. He's picking up the chalk in his beak, you know. And so... Then Sam goes back to his own fifth grade class, and, like, they have a fun time in there, and then that chapter's over, and 18 months later, the swan can write any dang word he wants.
How do you start with catastrophe and then take a year and a half to be able to write other stuff?
Yep. It's pretty good. Fine. It starts with cat, and then it goes to A, B, cat, and then catastrophe, and she's like, okay, well, I guess the swan can write whatever it wants. I will teach it written English.
Henry, as he is sort of learning more about reading and writing and spelling, has sorted words into three categories. There are short words, which are 2 to 4 letters long.
Okay.
There are medium words.
Medium words.
Which are 5 or 6 letters long. And then there are long words, which is every other length of word.
Henry!
So catastrophe, cat is a short word. Catastrophe is a long word. It's a long word.
It's a very long word.
Mm-hmm.
So Louis comes back from school, like Hamlet at the beginning of Hamlet. He's back from university, and nobody understands him.
He's haunted by a ghost of his uncle or whatever.
So he has this chalkboard around his neck now that he can write with, and it says "Hi there" on it. Mm-hmm. And he's walking around this lake, and none of the other swans can read. So he...
Yeah, because they didn't spend 18 months in high school in Montana.
but none of them even want to learn to read. So he's back home, and he still can't communicate with anyone. He has a conversation with the man who drops off all the grain for the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy's like, whoa, a talking swan. And then... he does fall in love with Serena, the swan, at first sight, but she does not notice him because he cannot go ko-ho, which is the swan noise.
The swan noise, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so Papa Cobb goes into action. He thinks that Louis is great. Here's a list of adjectives that gets interrupted that he thinks about his son. Louis is a trumpeter swan, noblest of all the waterfowl. He is gay, cheerful, strong, powerful, lusty, good, brave, handsome, reliable, trustworthy, a great flyer, a tremendous swimmer, fearless, patient, loyal, true, ambitious, desirous. I really liked lusty in that.
Lusty is good. It does read like sort of a brainstorming list for things that you could write on the web about the pig.
yeah,
in Charlotte's Web.
It does.
Can you imagine waking up one morning and above your pig's pen it just says Lusty? This is my Lusty pig, Wilbur.
So he flies to Billings, Montana, and robs a music store. He crashes through the front window of a music store and steals a trumpet.
This bothered me more than swans recognizing like borders and states is swans recognizing like ownership and theft as concepts.
Yes. So as he is flying away, okay, so the shopkeeper tries to shoot Papa Cobb with a gun, misses.
Right.
And the Papa Cobb is flying away carrying the stolen trumpet, and he says, he's like, "What have I done? I am by nature law abiding." "I did it to help my son.
Lawful,
I did it for love of my son, Louis."
Swan. Yeah.
Like, what? He does not know what a prison. He shouldn't know what a prison is.
He shouldn't know
about the Constitution or Miranda rights.
No, but like, I don't know if you look at Redwall, for example.
Well, there are no humans there.
There are some references to humans in the first Redwall.
We
just never see any on screen. But there are, I mean, there is a lot of like racial determination going on
where
some animals are born innately good and other animals are born innately bad, and you can't ever have any animal that crosses over between those two categories. So maybe swans are just born lawful good.
Maybe it is just a fun thing about this book is the messiness. Because there is not, as I said, like a parallel animal culture that it dives into.
Find out what the wild boars are up to or whatever.
No, and there's not like a, you know, a swan Jesus, like a Watership Down sort of thing. Like, they just kind of know more about human culture than makes any literal sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that it gets doled out in a way that makes the plot and the comedy of the book work, you know.
Okay. Cygnus Christ.
Yeah. Okay. Better than it should be.
I don't know.
He steals a trumpet and he gives it to Louis, and now Louis is walking and flying around with a trumpet and a chalkboard slate around his neck.
Okay.
He does remark that it's a little difficult to fly doing
it. It's kind of cumbersome, yeah.
He gets good at it. He can make sounds with a trumpet. Two problems arise. Serena has flown away with other swans, so he cannot impress her with his trumpet. Okay. Sad.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he does recognize that the trumpet was stolen and that they need to maybe pay this music store back.
That is so... okay. There's so many layers deep into things the swans should just like not know about or care about.
Yep, because then the rest of the book is this swan trying to earn enough money to pay back the store, Andrew.
Uh-huh.
He flies to Sam Beaver and gives Sam a quest. He says, "Help me pay for my trumpet.
I mean,
my dad robbed a store. I'm in trouble."
If this got ran up to the Supreme Court, like to determine whether swans can be held liable for crimes that they committed, if they go back to Canada, it's like an international thing. You gotta get the feds involved.
We have to extradite the swan.
Extradite a goose, yeah, or swan.
Sam's response is, "You need a job, bird. Come work at my summer camp that I'm going to."
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow is the last day of June. Papa's going to drive Louie and me to Camp Cuckoos. I bet it will be the only boys' camp in the world that has a trumpeter swan for the camp bugler. I like having a job. I wish I knew what I was going to be when I'm a man. Why does a dog always stretch when he wakes up?
Mm-hmm.
Sam's journal, man. You just got to log in and read that thing every day. So there's a few chapters set at this summer camp where Louis is the daily bugler, literally. Mm-hmm. Plays the trumpet in the morning to wake everybody up. He plays taps when everybody needs to go to sleep.
Now he's playing music on the trumpet and he's not like speaking swan through the trumpet.
That is a thing I'm very confused about.
Uh-huh.
And it's a thing I think when you talk about the disability rep in this book too is also relevant, is that he gets the trumpet, he can make the coho noise,
mm-hmm.
which is, that's how it's written, k-o-h-o-h in the book. He can make the trumpet the swan coho like hello noise. But there's never a scene where using the trumpet he has a conversation with another swan.
So it's addressing the problem that he can't, where he can't make noise, but it's not really addressing the communication issue entirely.
No. And there are times when he is playing songs. He writes a song about, like,
He
writes a song that does have, like, lyrics in his head. It is unclear if when he plays the song for Serena later, if she hears the lyrics or not. Okay. White does not make that clear. And I read it on first read that no one was hearing these lyrics. It's just a cool song he wrote.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of, yeah. That, to me, is the weirdest part of the book, is that he gets an adaptive aid that allows him to write human English so he can talk to humans.
Uh-huh.
And he gets an adaptive aid that allows him to make noise that ultimately is mostly used to play music for humans.
Okay.
Neither are...
But like, sometimes for swans.
So, well, and the swans appreciate the music, but the way everything is written, they hear it as music mostly rather than swan language.
Right.
And that's just weird. It's just weird. It doesn't map cleanly. It is like in service of a, like... Again, kind of what Updike said, kind of a, like, appreciation for pastoral beauty.
Because mm-hmm.
there's, like, scenes later in the book where, like, everyone in Philadelphia is hearing the swan play the trumpet. And all the animals and all the people in Philadelphia all love it. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what he plays to, you know, win Serena's heart.
He's still kind of communicating insofar as he's, like, expressing himself and yes. making himself seen and heard. I don't know.
It's just weird. It's just weird.
It's a little loose. It's a little loosey-goosey, which is funny because he's a swan.
Yeah. Every bird that isn't flying through the air, Simon thinks is a duck.
Yeah.
Henry
went through a phase where every animal was a puppy, including like chickens and stuff.
I just worry if Simon ever meets a goose and he calls it a duck, like what's going to happen?
Because yeah,
right now
he has
a toy goose and he calls it a duck, and I'm.
Yeah, that goose is going to get mad. I mean, geese get mad about everything anyway, but.
They're very temperamental creatures.
Yeah.
So he's at this camp. I'll gloss over most of the camp. Two things of note. He saves this boy named Applegate that nobody likes, and they bully him enough to going out into the lake by himself, even though he doesn't know how to like steer a boat, and he falls out of the boat.
Okay.
And then Louis has to save him, and everyone thanks Louis, but they're kind of still mad at Applegate about it. I think Applegate got a raw deal.
Uh-huh.
Because his main thing was that he didn't like birds, and everyone's like, we love this bird. What's your problem?
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have a good argument. But they do reach out to the U.S. government and have them issue Louis the life-saving medal, which is a real thing.
It's
one of
Louis's,
the oldest civilian medals in the United States.
Now the government knows about Louis, and he gets like inducted into whatever program that is with like the dolphins who go defuse bombs or whatever.
Yeah, he's a celebrity. And at the end of this chapter, he asks Sam to cut his webbed foot so that he can play the valves on the trumpet. Because the trumpet has three valves, which is how it plays all the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, he can only play bugle tunes. And if I could just work these valves with my three toes, I could play all sorts of music, not just bugle calls. I could play jazz. I could play country and western. I could play rock. I could play the great music of Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Sibelius, Gershwin, Irving Berlin, Brahms, everybody. I could really be a trumpet player, not just a camp bugler. I might even get a job with an orchestra. Louis, how do you know any of this?
You could play ska.
Well, ska hadn't been invented yet. Kick off the ska
craze. Well, I mean, humans appropriated it from swans.
Oh, man. Earlier in the book, there's a bit where some swans are literally, it says, playing water polo?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, if they know how to talk, they can learn human games, I guess.
And at the end of the book, when Louis has his own kids, spoiler, he plays taps for them at the end of the day. So now I guess swans know what taps is?
Do they have like 21 gun salute for swans?
Oh, maybe. We don't see it. This book is different from Charlotte's Web. No one dies.
Oh, that's too bad. I mean, probably somebody dies eventually.
Eventually. Not
but the, no, this book isn't for teaching you about death. It's for teaching you about how swans know about countries.
So after the
swans
camp,
recognize international treaties and stuff.
After the camp, Louis's like, hey, I need more money. And Sam goes, you could go to Boston and work with the swan boats.
Uh-huh.
So he does. So he flies
works
to
with he works with them.
He flies to Boston. He finds the swan boat operator and he has his little trumpet and he says, I could play music while you drive your swan boat.
Okay.
And he's a huge hit and everybody loves it.
And he gets paid for this?
He gets paid $100. He got paid $100 for the first summer at camp and now he gets paid $100 a week to be a swan boat trumpeter swan.
What?
The entirety of Boston loses their minds. He gets so popular that the swan boat operator pays for him to spend the night in the Ritz Hotel. Some Home Alone 2 shenanigans ensue. There's a funny joke where the guy's like,
"That's $813 in 2024 money." If you're assuming that the book takes place in 1970, which it might be even earlier than that.
Sure. There's some fun hijinks where they're checking the swan into the hotel and the hotel guy's like, well, is he famous? And the guy's like, well, yeah, he's a musician. And he's like, well, is he going to wreck the room because he's a musician? Very funny to me. And while
the swan puts the green M&Ms in his rider to make sure that the people running the event are paying attention.
So he only works for the swan boat for a week because he gets a literal telegram where a boy runs up to him with a telegram and says, I have a telegram for the swan.
Uh-huh.
And it says, can offer you $500 a week for nightclub spot, 10-week engagement. Please reply. Abe Lucky Lucas Hotel, Nemo, Philadelphia. And right then and there, the swan issues a response. I will be there tomorrow. Meet at zoo. How does he know that they're... What are we talking about?
How does he know about geography? How does he know about Philadelphia?
How does he know about zoos?
Yeah.
Again, like... You can imagine that maybe there are off-screen conversations where all swans do is sit around and talk about humanity.
They just look at maps and stuff, yeah.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
So then there's a whole situation where he is living at the zoo, in the bird lake at the zoo. This book loves the Philadelphia Zoo, and as somebody who does like the Philadelphia Zoo, it was kind of neat to read about it. You pointed out the kind of central tension around zoos that this book definitely gets into.
They are definitely just like cushy minimum security prisons for animals.
Yes. And I also, there's a poem later because like due to some situations, Louis summons Sam to the zoo for some help. And Sam has been like kind of aimless as a 10-year-old and he's like, well, now I want to be a zookeeper. And he writes like a little poem about how great the zoo is because it brings the animals to you.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a selfish human-centered point of view. I think the best thing about zoos is that they do animal conservation work, and can, you know, help injured animals and things like that. I do think we, you know, I certainly benefit from going to a zoo and looking at the animals and I like doing it.
Especially since having a kid, it has become like one of the things you can do to get out of the house for a couple hours, which is pretty valuable.
See an animal, you know? There's a couple times in this book where Sam is awed by just animals, and it did remind me of the one time I was in Denver, maybe, at the zoo. I was looking at some elephants, and somebody working at the zoo came up and asked me if I wanted to take a survey about the elephants, and one of the questions was, do you feel awe at the universe looking at the animals?
What did you say?
I said, yeah. They were cool elephants.
It feels like a leading question. Like, how do you answer no to that? I don't know.
I think I can't remember if it was on a Likert scale or not, or if it was just a yes no, but I definitely gave a positive response. So he's living at the zoo. His agent, this guy, Lucky Lucas, negotiated a deal where he plays at this nightclub 6 days a week, and if on his day of rest at the zoo he plays a concert at the zoo, he can stay there and they won't like trim his wings and make him a zoo animal.
Sure.
Because he's a person, because he can write.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
He can write and read. He's literate. He knows how to play an instrument. Like, he's...
Yeah.
You know, more, he's arguably more accomplished than I am in some ways.
A big old storm cast his lady love, Serena, out of the sky and into the zoo. And so now she's there, and it's fine because she has no agency as a character, so the rest of the book is about Louis trying to prevent her from being owned by the zoo and negotiating with the zookeeper like how he can like leave with her.
So I did read about this, and the deal is that he works out is that he's going to give some of his own children to the zoo, right?
Yeah. So he
dooms some of his children to imprisonment.
He sends another letter. Okay, so this is after he has already wooed Serena with his beautiful music. he does fight off zoo staff who try to pinion her and trim her wings. He sends an emergency telegram to Sam Beaver that says, "Am in the Philadelphia Zoo. This is an emergency. Come at once. I will pay your plane fare. Am now wealthy." Signed, Louis.
Does he have?
He has $5,000
direct deposit.
Like, he's carrying it in a bag around his neck.
He's gonna get.
Yeah.
He's gonna get killed.
He takes a cab to the club every day, and he hates performing there because it's so loud and noisy, and it's very late at night, and he can't choose his hours.
Someone get this swan an accountant. Like, yeah. Surely there's some kind of animal that could do numbers. I don't know, like probably something with a lot, like a spider or something with a lot of legs.
Yeah, this book does
be a
not
good accountant.
This book does not traffic in what other animals are up to that much.
But do we even see them at the zoo? Like, do they even talk to any other animals? It's weird that
not really. That we get a brief glimpse of some animals enjoying the music, but that's it.
I was gonna say it is weird that a swan would be a draw at the zoo, but you do go to the Philly Zoo, and there definitely are just like some normal birds in there.
Yep. Yep. There are three trumpeter swans there, but they're kind of old hat, and so maybe they need some new ones.
Maybe they need one that can play the trumpet. Well, maybe they need one that can juggle. Maybe
That's right. He's so popular at the zoo that the Philadelphia
maybe they need one
Orchestra
that can do taxes.
The Philadelphia Orchestra does invite him to perform with them because he's so good at the trumpet.
Oh my God.
And Sam is the one. Sam is the one who comes up with the idea to, okay, if you leave with your honey, you can have some babies, and every once in a while, you know, maybe you will leave one with the zoo. And his reasoning is, in every family of babies, at least one needs some extra assistance. So
okay.
Maybe you could
so
leave.
Let's put him in animal prison.
So maybe you could leave that one at the zoo where they can protect him and keep him healthy. That is the only line in this book that attempts to justify why this swan would leave any of his babies at the zoo.
And we're just taking for fact that out of every like clutch of swan eggs, there's one
just like him.
Dud swan that comes out of it.
Just like him, even though he, you know, went out into the world and became his own swan, and he doesn't need to live at a zoo and get help every day.
Yeah, but the other swans, you know, pull the ladder up behind you, Louis. Like
you're
playing with
Papa
the Philadelphia
Cobb
Orchestra. You don't need to help other swans get it like that.
We talked about how Papa Cobb uses a bunch of like really dated language about disability and is kind of, you know, he's a very long-winded guy, and it's a big contrast to Louis, you can't talk, and
you'd have to be long-winded to be able to play trumpet.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Good
that's
breath,
true.
Good breath control from these swans.
And I do wonder, though. I think maybe that Papa Cobb is a better dad than Louis, because Louis is willing to like give away a child to the zoo every year.
Yeah, Louis stole for his son.
Papa Cobb did,
or Papa Cobb stole for his
son.
And so, Louis is consigning his children to the
animal prison.
The correctional system for animals or whatever.
So we do close the loop on Papa Cobb, and this will kind of start to bring us home. We do get a scene where Louis flies home. Once again, he does not ever communicate directly with his parents through language, even though he has the trumpet, which ostensibly allows him to communicate. It's very confusing. E.B. White. I have notes. And he gives the bag of money to his dad, five grand, and he says, you know, and it's like clear that, like, okay, take that to go pay for the trumpet.
How much does Louis think a trumpet costs?
Unclear.
I don't know that it's $5,000, $1,970.
It's definitely not. Papa Cobb flies back there, is shot on sight by the shopkeeper.
Yeah.
There's a big kind of brouhaha in the street where an ambulance arrives. The game warden is there. The game warden is mad at the shopkeeper for shooting a protected animal. The shopkeeper's like, this animal robbed my store. there is a note like on Louis put his car, you know, his chalkboard slate on his dad's neck that like explains what's going on, or like a note in the bag or something. A judge appears out of the crowd.
Okay.
To, you know, mediate the conflict. And they call on a star witness, a young boy named Alfred Gore, who's just in the crowd saying what he saw. And I was just like, why is Al Gore here?
Why is Al Gore here? This is where he learned how to be a conservationist.
Yeah,
like
there's a joke later where he doesn't even know what the Audubon Society is. But, you know, I don't think that this is actually... Al Gore was 20 when this book came out. This is not a joke on Al Gore.
His name is also Albert, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's no, just, but it is funny that Alfred Gore...
It's silly.
Yeah.
It's the first thing I thought of. Mm-hmm. The judge awards the money to the store, but they do take the bird to the human hospital in the ambulance.
Okay, so the swan isn't dead.
Swan's not dead. He's just a nick. He's fine. And the shopkeeper gives the money to the Audubon Society because it really only costs like $100 for a trumpet, and he gives the rest to the Audubon Society.
Yeah. And then are he and the swan cool after that? Or
yeah, he's fine. The swan just leaves the hospital and flies home. And he's like, oh my God, I died. And the mom's like, no, you didn't. You're here, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And he decides, then we cut through time. We jump ahead, and Louis and his wife are having kids. And he's dropping one of them off at the zoo every once in a while.
Yikes.
And Sam is now 20 years old, still going on camping trips with his dad, and he sees some swans flying through the air. And that's that. You know?
Man. Man, oh man.
So it's a wild book. I found a Goodreads review that had 5 stars from Leslie.
That's more than we usually talk about.
This is the funniest beep, I swear. The humor in this book is surreal. The Cobb has me in stitches with over-the-top florid speeches, but it's the little details that kill me, like how nobody goes crazy when a bird learns how to read and write catastrophe. Like, just, that is what people like about this book. It's very silly.
Mm-hmm.
I did find a 3-star Goodreads review.
Oh, I don't have my guitar. 3-star Goodreads reviews.
From Sarah that said,
meh. She get a trumpet to play it.
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
Meh, strange, not a fan of the stealing of the trumpet. That's it. That's why Sarah didn't like the book.
No, I also am consider myself a lawful person.
So yeah, we talked about the Mary Ness article at Reactor Mag. The quote I had about the adaptive aids that I thought was neat. They say, from a disability standpoint, as an acknowledgement that not all medical aids will help under all circumstances or help all problems, and that in some cases, disabled users will need to work with one tool or aid in one situation and another tool aid in a second situation, with no one-size-fits-all situation. And that is an interesting perspective on the book, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He's got the one tool, he's got the other tool. I do think it is kind of whack that we don't get to see him functionally communicate with another swan.
That's the thing, is I don't know that the trumpet does function as a
yeah,
like an assistive tool in this situation, because he does learn to read and write human English, which helps him communicate. But then also on the side, he learns how to play the trumpet, which is a separate, entirely separate
thing. It allows him to go through a mating ritual with Serena where they coho at each other and then they bump necks a lot and they each think about the other person a lot, but it doesn't actually result in them having what we would see as a conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear to me if E.B. White intends us to believe that they have spoken with each other, mm-hmm. or otherwise, not doesn't have to be speak, but just otherwise communicated with each other, or if they just, you know, they communicate through physical touch and that's and singing and that's enough, you know.
Yeah.
It's unclear. And last, I'll just share so that the master's thesis, overall, I expected there to be more writing on this book than either of us found.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, we like there's a little bit of stuff, but mostly it's from like book blogs that kind of do the thing that we do, where we just kind of read old stuff and throw our thoughts at the wall about it.
I did not expect kind of the best source I could easily find to be a master's thesis from Cal State. Like, was a pretty good article by Amelia Brown that I read, but I usually would expect to find other sources. And she compares this with Stuart Little and just talking about disability depiction in these books. Like, Stuart Little as somebody who is just like existing in a world that is not built for him is kind of what she's writing about there.
Mm-hmm.
But then for Trumpet of the Swan, she acknowledges a lot of the problematic language and the kind of conflation with overcoming an obstacle and needing to be a sexual creature, and but also it's this interesting you know, story about adaptation and things like that. And her closing point is, Louis is now able to live a full life just as he wants, not as a, quote, deformed swan with no future life, not as a, quote, spectacle with humans, but as he chooses, a free and independent life. He's still voiceless, but has made adaptations that work well for him. He is the epitome of social disability change in that he asks for access, makes changes in his environment, and chooses the life he wants for himself. He finds a way to communicate, to find employment, nurtures a talent he has, makes a decision to attract a mate, and builds a strong self-image. Humans and swans come to respect his differences and choices. And then he
donates his kids to a prison.
Yeah, that really undercuts our love of Louis, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I thought that was...
But it's okay, because I think it would help them to be in prison.
Thanks,
says
Sam.
Louis.
Thanks, Sam Beaver.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun reading this book, and I've had a lot of fun thinking about this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also just really love the animals are cool, huh? And we should respect them and love them angle as well. Like, that is underpinning the whole book. And probably we didn't talk about it as much because there's a lot of other stuff to talk about.
There's a lot of other stuff, like animals knowing about countries and whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they all know human English.
But not how to read or write it. Well, because they went to school for it.
And also, the government knows that a swan saved a boy in a lake, and then there are newspaper articles about a swan playing the trumpet for money.
Mm-hmm.
This is where my brain always is like, why is the government not like talking to all the swans?
Well,
already, you know,
like, how is this the first time this has happened?
Yep.
I guess.
Yep. Definitely, for sure.
That's part of the reason why you don't have more animals that you run into, is it raises so many more questions than it answers that E.B. White does not want to just open the
can. He does not want to talk about that at all.
Because then you have to talk about a worm who like learned how to play the drums like in the They Might Be Giants song.
or then he meets the rat from Ratatouille, you know.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Oh man. Okay. Well, that's the book.
Trumpet of the Swan.
Hey, Trumpet of the Swan. If you, the listener, want to tell us your favorite swan songs, send us an email, overduepod@gmail.com. Hit us up on social media @overduepod. We're often on Blue Sky and Instagram. Our theme song is composed by Nick Larangis. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where do they go?
Overduepodcast.com is our internet website. We have March's schedule up there now. Next week, I'm going to be reading They're There by Tommy Orange.
Yeah.
They're There.
They're There?
They're There.
They're There!
We've also got links up there to our Patreon page, patreon.com/overduepod. Get bonus episodes early. Get episodes of our long read project, Stop Homer Time, early. We're talking about Emily Wilson's translation of the Iliad. It's a good time. get access to our Discord server, and so TV VCR repair, and so much more.
Sure.
Patreon.com/OverduePod. Thank you, everybody, for listening to our podcast again for another week. Let us know what you think about what animals will play what instruments. I think that would be fun.
Yes, like please tell us. Yes.
And until we talk to you next week, please try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.